Hello, I'm Mark Steiner, and welcome. We have a live broadcast tonight from here at Morgan State University at the Carl Murphy Fine Arts Center, right on our campus. And we're gathered tonight to launch a new book by Bob Luke titled The Baltimore Elite Giants, Sports and Society in the Age of Negro Baseball, published by Johns Hopkins University Press, who's sponsoring this evening as well. This hour, I'll be speaking with Bob Luke and Bert Simmons. Bob Luke wrote the book. He's also author of other books, including Dean of Umpires, the biography of Bill McGowan, 1896 to 1954, and Willie Wells, the El Diablo of the Negro Leagues. And we're joined by Bert Simmons, gracing our stage, who is a pitcher for the Baltimore Elite Giants and is the last surviving Elite Giant member who lives in our area here in Baltimore. We're going to take your questions from the audience. There's a microphone right down here to my right. We don't want you to be shy, and we'll open those questions when you feel like jumping up. The spirit moves you, move yourself to the mic and join the conversation. We'd love to have you there with us. Otherwise, just sit back and enjoy this conversation we're about to have. And gentlemen, welcome. It's a pleasure to see both of you, Bob Luke and Bert Simmons.
Thank you. Nice to be here.
I want to say also that we should also thank Darker Than Blue, which is catering tonight. They are a restaurant on Greenmount Avenue. They're here this evening, and they're a restaurant with a little bit of New Orleans, a little bit of Seoul, a little bit of New York, all wrapped up in some really good food, which we'll partake in when this is over. So you should come down here right now and have good food and great discussion. I was so excited when I saw this book. It's just so wrapped up in our history. I mean, it says so much about America. And I think we all know those names like Satchel Paige, and we all, Josh Gibson, the names that are on people's lips who know about baseball and know about the Negro Baseball Leagues. Mm-hmm. But there's so many other people, and it's such a complex history that we don't know about, and what it meant to be a player in that time and in those leagues. Mm-hmm. So let me turn first to to you, Bob, just to talk a bit about just why you did this book and what drew you to the Elite Giants.
Well, I had always been interested in baseball, Mark, as a kid and in high school. And so when I retired, I took up baseball writing as a hobby. And as you mentioned, one of the books I did was on Willie Wells, a Negro League shortstop. I had heard nothing about the Negro Leagues. I came across his name. I thought it would be an interesting story to pursue. In the course of that story, I learned about the Baltimore Elite Giants, and they were just right up the road from where I lived in Garrett Park. Nothing much had been written about the Elite Giants. They were a very powerful team. They were very much a highlight of the social life in Baltimore during the time that they were here, and I just kind of got intrigued with their story and thought it would be an interesting story to tell, which it certainly was for me, I can say.
So, Bert Simmons, it really is great to have you up here on stage. I want to thank you for coming up today.
It's a pleasure to be here.
Good to have you here. So, to talk a bit about, just to introduce yourself to our audience, people who many people may know your name, many people may not know your name, but you pitched the Elite Giants. Talk about you playing baseball as a kid and your sojourn into the Elite Giants.
As a kid, growing up in rural North Carolina, you had nothing to do during the summer but find some ball and play with it. So baseball was what I had to do. There was no basketball and very few baseball teams, or teams that I could play with. During my early years, there was segregation all over. Every place that you went, there was a segregation situation. So playing baseball was out of the question for African Americans in the South. Other kids had little leagues, club leagues, something to occupy their time when they were not at school or during the summertime. My situation, when school closed in June, that was it for the summer. So you had to find something to do. And I found baseball. I found baseball because down the street from where I lived was a baseball park. There was a Coastal Plain Class D baseball league. And I made it my business to be at that ballpark every day. I had nothing else to do. So I would help the groundkeeper. I would rake it, cut the grass, or whatever has to be done. I did it. So consequently, I learned the game. I saw the players in Class D ball.
This is a white team.
White team.
It was a white team.
There was no black teams. So I learned the game from watching them. And I got the equipment. I got a glove. I got a bat. And I would go around from glove, my glove and the ball, looking for somebody to play with. So this is the way I learned how to play. And there were no organized teams in my hometown. I wanted to play. I tried to organize a Boy Scout team, but half of the scouts wanted to play, and the other half wanted to do something else. So I lost out on that. But being a Boy Scout, you persevere. And eventually we got together 9 Boy Scouts that wanted to stand around and act like they were playing baseball. So we got that together, and we played another scout troop. Played another scout troop from a nearby town. And we did fine. We beat them every time we played.
So, two-team league, and you won all the time.
Yeah, that's good. So that's my entrance to playing baseball.
And what year was that when you were a kid down there?
That was, let's say, the late 30s. Late 30s. That was right after the Depression, and no gloves. Nobody had equipment. So late 30s. And baseball was a game for me. I enjoyed it. I learned the game.
And played it well.
I learned it. And by watching, I could play any position. I wasn't a catcher. I didn't trust myself blinking my eye when somebody swung at the ball. I didn't trust that. So I wasn't a catcher. But the other positions, I thought I did well with. That's why you try out for a team and you size them up. Now, what do they need? This is the way I did when I went to school, college. I watched the team practice, and I decided that I wanted to be a second baseman on this team. Not knowing that they had the best second baseman in the conference, sitting over there waiting to get on the field. So I decided maybe I should pitch. So they needed a pitcher. So I was a pitcher and did fine.
And what college was that?
North Carolina A&T State University. It wasn't called State University at that time, but North Carolina A&T College, Greensboro.
If you're just tuning in, we're having a live broadcast, a town meeting here tonight, talking about the Baltimore Eli Giants. The book is written by Bob Luke, and we're talking, of course, right now to Bert Simmons, who is a pitcher for the Baltimore Eli Giants, and the Negro baseball leagues that were all over this country, and in Baltimore City. We've had a couple teams here in the Negro baseball leagues, and I remember them well, kind of, as a kid, just because the stories I heard and people going to the games, and my first father-in-law tried to get into the leagues and he played. And I mean, it's such a powerful piece of our history, just in terms of the men who played this game. And you write about them, Bob Luke. The men who played this game clearly weren't playing for the money, given what white players were making and what black players were making in those days. This is a game where these men had to play. It was a passion. It was a piece of life.
Oh, that it was. It was very much a piece of life for them and a very large part of their life. And as you say, the money they made did not compare at all with the money that the major leaguers, even the minor leaguers, played. I don't know, an average salary might start at $125, $150 a month in the early 40s. Some of the stars would make $600, $700, $800 maybe a month. But I would also point out that within the African-American community, the pay that baseball, that Negro League baseball players received was far above the average salary available to African-Americans employed in other pursuits, who very often had low-income jobs and were largely discriminated against by various corporations, city government, state government, what have you. So to be a Negro League ball player was really a mark of distinction and social status within the African-American community.
We'll get into some of the personalities in this game. That's part of what I liked about the book, is that this was as much, this was about black Baltimore in the 20s, 30s, 40s, and 50s, 60s even. Mm-hmm. And about the role that this, the Eli Giants played in the community. Mm-hmm. And I think that's, there's been, people maybe just now need to scratch the surface about how incredible a community existed during segregation here in Baltimore, and, mm-hmm. and that the Eli Giants were part of that. I mean, it's, were you about to say something? Look, are you about to say something on that?
Well, when I came to Baltimore was quite a jumping town, you can call it.
It was.
Yes. We had a section of Pennsylvania Avenue that had the clubs, the eating establishments. They had the businesses for blacks, businesses owned by blacks. And this is what I found when I came here. Some of this was brand new to me.
Did you come here right from North Carolina?
No, not really. I made a couple of stops, baseball stops along the way.
Okay.
And my last stop before coming to Baltimore was in New Jersey, Atlantic City. I played with the Hall of Famer there called Pop Lloyd, John Henry Pop Lloyd. And he was quite a ball player. He's in the Hall of Fame. But from there, I got a tryout with the Eli Giants. And I was asked to come to Baltimore by a certain date. And so I had to get the bus, travel to Wilmington, which was a segregated town, Wilmington, Delaware. I had to eat around on the side. Had my food passed through the window, and the other patrons of the bus ate inside. I had to go around to the window. Anyway, I was coming to Baltimore. That was 1950. I met the owner of Baltimore, Eli Giants, and I thought that was an odd way to say Elite Giants. But they told me it was Elite Giants. And that's what I was supposed to call them. So they were Eli Giants then, Eli Giants now. So I signed a contract. You were saying $400 or $500 a month. My contract stated that I was to get $200 a month. And I figured that out to be $50 a week. Okay. So that's what my salary was. I didn't mind that. I wanted to play baseball. I had done it all my life. I made a lot of stops, I say. And I never got paid that much money at one time for playing. They passed the hat when I played sometimes, and you put whatever you could in the hat. Then you got paid. But this was a salary that I knew I would be getting every second and fourth week. That was my salary when I came here. But Baltimore was, you had the Pennsylvania Avenue group, which was quite a treat if you hadn't been out of town, hadn't been out of the South. We had no such thing as a club, especially a jazz club in the South. But Pennsylvania Avenue had everything. You could see all the stars that you read about. Nat King Cole, Lou Armstrong, Ella Fitzgerald. Anybody of note came to Pennsylvania Avenue to perform. And this is what I found in Baltimore.
And the personalities in this game, I never thought about it. I really got to tell you, Bob, since I read the book. There were these larger-than-life people who owned these teams.
Mm-hmm. That they were.
And the battles that went on inside these teams.
That they were.
I mean, I've read about the leagues and read about the players, but, I mean, you got into the world of the men and women too,
mm-hmm.
who own these teams.
Right.
That were just, well, let you start. I mean, talk a bit about, I could throw a couple names out, but let me just ask you, I'm just curious. Who, and I'll ask you the same question in a minute. Who really jumps out of your favorite personalities that you discovered writing this book on the owner's side?
On the owner's side, I think one clearly has to be the owner of the Eli Giants, Tom Wilson, who, like many of the owners of Negro League teams, made his money through the numbers game, which was illegal at the time but was a big enterprise in the African American communities.
Big in Baltimore.
And big in Baltimore, yes, absolutely.
A lot of customers around.
And who knows, may still be big for all. It's not too different from the lottery.
Right.
But,
well, yeah, except more of a hustle, but anyway.
Right. He was from Nashville. He had some clubs in Nashville. He had a fondness for women that resulted in four wives. He dressed very well, pinstripe suits, always big wads of money in his suit. Very laid back, easygoing guy, didn't have a file cabinet, didn't have a head for business. And the counterpart to the Tom Wilson in the Negro Leagues was Effa Manley, one of the women you referred to, who was the general manager for the Newark Eagles. And she was the Negro League owner. She wasn't actually the owner, but she acted like an owner. Her husband, Abe, owned the team. But she had the vision and the drive and the energy to try and professionalize Negro League Baseball, made lots of proposals. They didn't get anywhere because the guys who owned the other teams, first of all, were a little put off that a woman was making these suggestions, and they really didn't want to be too organized. They liked the loose structure. They could make any kind of deals they wanted to, and they didn't have a commissioner, and they were quite comfortable in operating that way. Now, they were all characters.
There were two leagues, right?
We had
the Negro National League and the American League.
Right.
And the American League was on the East Coast.
National League.
The National East Coast, and the American League was it Midwestern?
Midwestern.
Right. And the lack of money that they had, I mean, caused these teams to hustle. I mean, people had to.
Oh, yeah.
I mean, they played extra pickup games. They would never stop. You'd have to train him by Roy Campanella, where he talked about catching. I mean, the great catcher, one of the greatest catchers of all time, who started out in the Negro Leagues, Roy Campanella. You have him talking about in the book where he said he caught four full games in one day.
Right.
I mean, four 36 innings in one day.
Right.
And it was a different world.
Oh, yeah, very different world. And they rode on buses. They didn't travel by train or plane. They rode buses. They traveled day and night. We didn't have superhighways in those days. Oftentimes, they didn't have time to change their uniforms. And often, they didn't have places to change their uniforms. Some of the hotels wouldn't let them in to change their uniform. Even some of the ballparks where they played, they would rent out major league ballparks to play when the majors were on the road. And sometimes, the locker rooms in the major leagues were not available to the Negro League players, even to change uniforms. So they had, and as Bert was saying, they oftentimes had to get their meals from behind the restaurant or under, you know, very separate conditions, hard to find hotels to stay in. So it was a struggle. It was, clearly was a struggle.
So when you were pitching for the Eli Giants, Bert Simmons, was Roy Campbell a catcher when you were playing?
No, he wasn't.
He was gone by that time.
Yeah. Johnny Hayes and Sam Henry. Yeah. Campanella was gone. Junior Gilliam played on the team that I played. Mm-hmm. Joe Black.
Joe Black played on the team.
Joe Black, yeah. Played on the team with Junior. Joe Black is a graduate of Morgan State. He did well. But speaking of owners, when I came here, I was under the impression that Dick Powell was owner of the Baltimore Eli Giants.
Yeah, he was then, yeah.
But I found out later Dick didn't like the title. Oh. He said, don't call me the owner. I'm not the owner. He kept saying that to me. But anyway, he treated me quite well. I enjoyed his friendship, and hopefully, and I made an impression on him. I must have, because he called me and said, come to Baltimore right away. Signed me to the contract. So if it wasn't for Dick Powell, I guess we wouldn't be talking.
You played from what year to what year?
I played 50 to 52.
50 to 52. Yeah. And the Negro Baseball League started
going down.
Going downhill. So it's right. So it was. I'm going to go back into history in a minute here about how this began and at the height of their playing back in the 30s, especially in 40s. But I wonder what it was like for men like you who may have been good enough to play in any major league team but were playing, were segregated out of those teams.
Right.
And knowing you were kind of at the end of the train, so to speak, of the Negro Baseball Leagues, they were kind of, because the era was changing and the Major League Baseball was opening up and the Supreme Court was integrating schools and things were really beginning to change. Mm-hmm. So what was that like for you back then? I mean, was it in terms of the maybe perhaps the frustration, or maybe it wasn't frustration for you? I mean, just how was it in that period for you?
Well, when the big changes came about, this is schools and restaurants and everything else, hotels, I was out of baseball. And it was a social happening as far as I was concerned. But a good thing that it did happen.
Right.
I welcomed the opportunity to see many of my companions, many of my friends, many of the fellows that I had played baseball with get the opportunity to at least get a tryout. You know, get a tryout with the team that would matter. So I welcome that in my lifetime. During my lifetime, I never got that opportunity. I didn't have an opportunity to go across the street where I lived and play on the playground. It wasn't for me to go over there and play. It was a playground for white kids, not for black kids. We didn't have a playground. We didn't have swings and sliding boards and all that. This was an elementary school across the street from where I lived. Skating rink. They built a skating rink on that playground for white kids.
On your playground?
It wasn't my playground. It was the city's playground.
Right.
And the skating rink that they built, I'll never forget it. The white kids would skate all day long. I would wait until night when it got dark, I'd take my skates, skate all over the skating rink. When I saw a car coming, I would lay down on the ground so they wouldn't see me. Got up and skated some more. This was a skating rink on the playground across the street from where I lived. So I thought about that years later. I said, that's ridiculous. I learned to skate quite well. I did it at night. That's the situation that we grew up in. Grew up. I think I did all right.
I think you did all right, too. Mm-hmm. Yes, you did.
Thank you, dear.
We're talking here, broadcasting live from Morgan State University, as we always do, but we're a special show tonight with the Carl Murphy Fine Arts Center. We're talking about a book that Bob Luke wrote called The Baltimore Elite Giants, Sports and Society in the Age of Negro Baseball, published by Johns Hopkins University Press. And we're also joined by Bert Simmons, who is part of this book. He was part of those leagues. He was a pitcher with the Baltimore Elite Giants and is the last surviving Elite Giant to live in our area here in Baltimore. We have a live audience here at the Murphy Fine Arts Center, and I want to encourage people that have questions, thoughts, experiences to share to please come to the microphone that's here to my right, and don't be shy and join in on this conversation. Just take whatever you think it needs to go, places I'm missing and places you things you want to hear about yourself. So going back to the book for a moment, the picture you paint, what was the name of the movie that was made about the Negro Baseball Leagues, where they were barnstorming across the South?
Oh.
Right. That was a movie that kind of showed the guys kind of barnstorming through the South and stuff. But what you showed in the book was something I thought fascinating, interesting to explore, which was the social dynamic among the owners and general managers of the teams.
Mm-hmm.
When they wanted to professionalize the leagues, when these two guys you'll talk about who became the heads of their leagues respectively, but they wanted to replace them with people who had much more stature. Talk a bit about that. That's a really, when I was reading that part of the book, I kept thinking to myself, this is a movie scene. This is a play. I could see this happening around a boardroom with all these incredible characters, large, like some really flashy, throwing out the money with their suits, others kind of being very serious about, you know, what we have to do for the community and make things different. There was a social dynamic going on inside of there that said a lot about the dynamic inside the segregated black world at the same time.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm. Well, it could make a good movie. The owners would have owners' meetings 2-3 times a year, alternate amongst the cities, usually at a hotel.
Let me ask you to pull that mic a little closer.
Oftentimes here in Baltimore, they would meet at the York Hotel at 1200 Madison Street. So they would all come together, and Wilson was a nominal chairman, and they would all throw out ideas for scheduling and for contracts and who wanted to hire what player, and they would resist any proposal that F.A. Manley and others made to bring in a commissioner or someone of a higher status to provide overall organization and leadership. And they yelled and screamed at one another. You read the write-ups in the press of the day, and you hear the owners yelling and screaming, calling one another names. And oftentimes they'd lock the sports writers out of their meetings. So the sports writers are in the lobby listening to this screaming and yelling going on behind closed doors, and then they can only kind of get secondhand reports from any of the owners who wanted to talk about what went on there. And they had no office, no central office. They didn't even have a central filing cabinet. People just brought papers with them.
But you had, the situation, I'm trying to find the part in here now, where the people, when I was reading this, one of the things that hit me was, right, they're in a lot of the world back in the 40s and 50s. It was similar in some ways in the Jewish world, Italian world, and the black world, but in the black world especially. If you had to make it, unless you were a doctor or a teacher, mm-hmm, or a lawyer or something like that, people had a job or a business going, but a hustle. And the hustle was usually numbers or was something similar.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
So there was this whole world of And that puts you right close to the street, and you puts you close to a fair, fast world. That's part of that life. The battle going on there was when they were trying to get the then president of Howard University Law School to be head of the Mona Lees.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
And kind of trying to... So I was thinking about, I could see this kind of clear demarcation between mm-hmm. kind of old black middle class elite saying, you know, we have to tighten this up.
Mm-hmm.
And the new guys in the block making some money going, no, we own this now, and we're going to do it this way.
Exactly right.
And there was this culture war going on mm-hmm. at the top of the Negro baseball leagues
mm-hmm.
that was very fascinating, the stuff that you were kind of writing about.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Did you feel that going on when you were playing?
No, I didn't. My idea of what went on was the owner of the Eli Giants. He was the only one that I knew. He was the only one that I met. I didn't meet Mrs. Effie Manley. I didn't meet Composey, Peterson, Kansas City.
Right.
I didn't meet those people. I dealt with Dick Powell. And the goings-on behind the board doors, I had no idea what was happening. I wanted to play baseball, and this is what I was doing. I didn't own the team, so let them squabble who's going to be the president or the commissioner. I didn't care.
Just want to play baseball.
I want to play baseball.
Did the players ever talk about it?
Not that I know of.
Right.
No.
This is the quote I was talking to you all about before we started on the air, and I think it kind of, I'm jumping a little ahead here, but I think that it's kind of really interesting. There are a couple of quotes that really struck out at me. One, they really have to do from the white perspective and what people thought. This was Branch Rickey, who owned the Dodgers, who brought, as we know, Frank Robinson, into play for the Dodgers, Jackie Robinson. And he said of the Negro baseball leagues that they are not leagues and have no right to expect organized baseball to respect them.
Mm-hmm.
They have the semblance of a racket,
mm-hmm.
he said. And they had no contracts, no legal league schedules, no constitutions, no written contracts with the players. And so they want to know parts of the players or the league.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
I mean, so it was, and also many people didn't respect the many white people. Didn't respect the caliber of play.
Right. Mm-hmm.
So, I mean, that was a big piece of this.
Well, those two themes that you mentioned, Mark. That the last one, a lot of whites did not respect the black players. There were a lot of whites thought they were not comparable to the major league skill level. But there are 30 players in the Hall of Fame based solely on their time in the Negro Leagues. So many Negro League teams beat Major League teams in exhibition games. And it got to the point where Landis, the Major League commissioner, finally outlawed Major League teams from playing as a whole team against Negro League teams because it was embarrassing to the Major League Baseball establishment. The other thing I would point out is that in Baltimore and in other Negro League cities, as Bert had alluded to earlier, baseball was a big social event for African Americans. I mean, the ballpark, Bugle Field in the case of Baltimore and occasionally Oriole Park, was one place African Americans could go and dress to the hilt and have picnics and take drinks in. It didn't have to matter who they looked at or how they looked or where they walked. They were completely free. And it was comparable to the church in that respect, that was one. One of the players called it a haven, that a Negro League baseball was a happening. And inside the ballpark was a very different and much more egalitarian, socially freeing, et cetera, social milieu for African Americans. Some whites also attended the games, 5-10% sometimes, but the vast majority of the fans were African Americans.
You talked about it was Charles. The other player was Charles Osgood.
Yeah.
Charles Osgood's father.
Charles, yes, right.
And Charles Osgood
right.
Was brought to a game by his dad and would watch the Elites, but he held them in low esteem. And he said when Charles Osgood, the child, asked his father, Charles Osgood Sr., why the Elites were not playing in the minors and majors, the father said, "Well, Charlie, they're flashy, all right, but they're not steady enough to play a whole season." And they were not one to be bronzed, was the word he used as well.
Yeah.
So he
characterized the fans, the white fans, as closet Confederates, which no doubt they were, many of them.
So let's talk about some of the kind of interesting men who played this game. I think that there were so many phenomenal people here. That played in this game, and we just don't know them because a lot of them. I mean, we know the names that were remembered because they made the Hall of Fame or because they ended up playing in the majors, like Satchel Paige and those guys.
Right.
But there's a lot of guys that played for Tom Wilson's team here in Baltimore that we just don't know. I mean, let's talk about a couple of them. Let's see. Let's pick some out of here, like Wild Bill Wright.
Wild Bill Wright. Okay. Right. Now, he had left Baltimore by the time you had come, Bert, right? He was not there. He was an outfielder. He got his name Wild Bill, not because of his errant throws from the outfield, because he also was a pitcher in his early days and was wild from the mound. He had a reputation for being a mean character. Would come in with his spikes up, reveled at trying to, the term was undress the infielder. You undress the infielder with your spikes. He was very good at doing that. He played a lot of baseball in Mexico. He would jump from the Elites occasionally, get out and play in Mexico where he could double and triple his salary. Liked Mexico so much, he moved to Mexico. At the end of his playing days, opened up a bar, died in Mexico. He only came back to the States once for a card show and is in the Mexican Hall of Fame, Baseball Hall of Fame in Mexico.
Well, this is interesting. That's a digression. I was going to talk about players. Let's do this for a minute, though. I mean, one of the interesting pieces about the Negro Baseball League is that the contracts that people had weren't legally binding.
Right. Like,
so people, because they had to make money, left the team and often went to play in Mexico, Latin America, Cuba, because that's where you could make a buck.
Right.
Where Campanella jumped and left and went to...
Right.
Mexico to play, and then came back, and they tried to ban him from playing because he broke his contract, but they couldn't very well say no to Roy Campanella. They needed a catcher.
Right.
So that was before your time. Or just
before my time, yes. I read of cases, heard of cases, where they ignored a contract. If you wanted me to play for your team, I'll come over.
In the middle of a season.
Yeah.
Right.
Anytime.
The old time.
And... there was no contract. We just forget the contract. So this happened quite a bit. Now, in all cases, it didn't. I don't think Dick Powell would allow. Dick Powell was the general manager of Baltimore Elites. I don't think he allowed that to happen. Even booking teams that were clowns.
And there was a team called the Clowns.
Yes.
Right.
The owners of the Negro League teams didn't like that.
Right.
They didn't like baseball being degraded to something that you had to clown to play it. They didn't like it. So they frowned on it, and they had a situation where the owners were trying to boycott the clowns because of the actions that they had on the field. I don't know how it worked. It didn't work out because the clowns had a big drawing card. They would draw a lot of people when they came to town. So instead of throwing the money away, they just said, well, do what you have to do. And you had the clowns.
And that you write about the clowns in your book as well. I mean, this is a big thing with people because they were the police, people who played in the clowns were really cutting up and acting a fool, like on the field, not playing the game seriously. And as you were saying, that they didn't the owners and the players said, no, we're just not going to play.
They didn't like that. No, they.
Now, the Clowns were an offshoot of the House of David. House of David wore beards. You know, they would play the game as though they were clowns. But they had beards on. House of David. I'll never forget them.
And where were they from?
All over. I don't know the hometown or whatever. But they would travel, play anybody. But they were called the House of David. And I don't know how they weren't in the league, but they did clowning also.
And there was also a battle in Baltimore over where the game would be played, especially in the beginning of the team. When Eli Chimes became the Baltimore Eli Chimes coming from Memphis.
Nashville. Nashville.
At the right state. Came from Nashville. And so, but the Oriole Park was the White Park. Where the minor league Orioles played. And there were certain restrictions.
Right. There had been a long history of Negro League teams not being allowed to play in Oriole Park. The owners, I think Jack Dunn was one of them, and just wouldn't allow Negro League teams to play, you know, segregation, discrimination. Finally, in 1937, the booking agents for the Negro Leagues managed to get two games of the Negro League World Series played at Oriole Park, and that was a real major event. And after that, the Eli Giants were able to play in Oriole Park when the Orioles, these are the Orioles, the International League minor league team at the time, when they were out of town. But then in 1942, there was an opening day doubleheader, and in the after the doubleheader was over, a small fight broke out among some of the fans, and I don't know, they damaged a couple of seats, very minor damage, but it was enough in the eyes of the owners to just bar the team henceforth from Oriole Park, and so they had then to go to the east side of Baltimore and play at Bugle Field, which was a much smaller stadium. I think maximum capacity was maybe 6,000. Is that about right, Bert? About 6,000 people. And it was very uncomfortable. You know, not much roof, and it rained. You got wet. Earthen floor in the shower room and everything. It was another example of difficult conditions under which the Negro Leagues and the Eli Giants had to play.
We're broadcasting live this evening from the Murphy Fine Arts Center here at Morgan State University. You just heard Bob Luke, who wrote the book Baltimore Eli Giants, Sports and Society in the Age of the Negro Baseball, published by Johns Hopkins University Press, who's helping to sponsor this event this evening. Bert Simmons is with us, who wrote about in this book one of the great pitchers in the Baltimore Eli Giants, and is the last Eli Giant living, at least living in Baltimore. We have a live audience here, and folks, we begin to encourage you. Go ahead. Come up to the mic and ask questions. Throw out thoughts for our guests.
Question for each of you. Mr. Simmons, as a pitcher, I wonder who is the toughest batter that you ever faced, and as a batter, who is the toughest pitcher you ever faced?
Toughest batter would be the lineup for the Hope and State of Grace. Everybody on the team was a tough batter. So it's hard to say. There was a night when I pitched against a gentleman from the New York Black Yankees that remembered hitting everything that I threw. And he let me know that. So you threw me a knuckleball at first, I hit it against the wall. You threw me a curveball, I hit it for a single. So everything that I threw him, he remembered and told me about it. So I guess he was tough. Like I said, most of the hitters that I faced, I considered tough. Tough hitters.
Did you ever face Satchel Paige as a batter?
Satchel Paige. Yes.
Could you tell us?
I batted against Satchel Paige in one of the games we played at the stadium. And Sancho knew that I wasn't a hitter. You know, I'm a pitcher. Mm-hmm. Not supposed to hit. So he threw me a fastball. I thought I saw the ball. So the next one was a good curveball, as fast as the first fastball was. Two strikes, right? I said, well, I'm swinging. I don't care where it is or what it looks like. I'm swinging. Sure enough, fastball. And he would throw at your knees, knee high. So you didn't get a chance to swing for it. You had to be a good low ball hitter. And I wasn't a good hitter at all. So the third pitch went by me. I swung, took my seat on the bench. So Sergeant Hayes was good. He was as good as advertised. Very good.
Thank you.
He had good control. That was the main thing.
I have a question
now,
for
May I inject this?
Okay.
Orioles had a boy, not a boy, a ball player that could throw as hard as anybody. Had a good curveball, but he couldn't throw strikes. Still can't throw strikes. The Orioles sent him away to another team. And the last that I saw of him, he was throwing the ball high, low, bouncing, hitting people, can't throw strikes. Has all the tools that you need. If I had those tools. But you have to throw strikes in this game. I learned to do that. Yes.
Can I ask a question of Mr. Luke? Your book is getting phenomenal response. It's a great book. But, and as somebody who's written about this period in the history of the Negro Leagues, and how do you explain that now, this many years later, you know, 50, 60 years later, there's finally people paying serious attention to these clubs, these leagues, when they didn't, when they were, you know, back in the day when they were actually part of the landscape?
Mm-hmm. It's a good question, and I think a lot of the former players have a lot to do with that. After the Negro Leagues kind of faded, the players would hold reunions in different places in the country, Ashland, Kentucky, and so forth, and those would be publicized. Also, I think there is a seminal book written on the Negro Leagues, 1970. Robert Peterson wrote Only the Book Was White, which was really the first book ever written in any depth on the Negro Leagues. And since that time, there have been innumerable books written about the Negro Leagues. But, you know, and I would also like to think that part of the reason that there is attention now to the Negro Leagues is that people, African-American and otherwise, are interested in knowing more about that part of history and what it was and what it meant from perspective of today, and become a little more familiar with their history.
There's some kind of very telling, you have a lot of great quotes in this book, and some of them really hit me because they were just kind of very telling of the emotional toll on the players who played in the game. You know, we don't think about that. We always just, whether it's until the Vietnam War, we never talked about post-traumatic stress disorder in soldiers because we just didn't talk about it. And then, you know, people came back and were sort of making noise about it, and then people paid attention to it. In these leagues, I'm going to read some quotes for our listeners and people in the audience out of the book we're talking about tonight, Bob Luke's book, The Baltimore Eli Giants. Bert Simmons, who pitched for them, is with us as well. It's really the only reason I came to meet Bert Simmons. I'm just kidding. It's a good book, but I wanted to meet Bert Simmons. Clinton McCord, who was the first baseman in the American Association. And they gave him a silver glove in 1956 and 58. And he talked, this is his quote. This is an amazing quote. Teared me up the first time I saw it. It's hard to read even. when he talked about the Negro baseball leagues. He said, we were in the slave market back then. We couldn't go anywhere else because there was nowhere else to go. If we wanted to play baseball, we had to play when and where the owners told us to play. It took 15 years to get over the hurt of not making it to the majors. Mm-hmm. I mean, these were men who were great players. Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. And were not allowed in.
Yeah, all right. And a lot of them had feelings very similar to Butch McCord's. Monty Irvin, who played with the Newark Eagles and went on to a Hall of Fame career with the New York Giants, he said he did not feel angry, but he felt very frustrated and very disappointed at the lack of ability to play in the majors when he was in his prime.
Well, I mean, the Biz Mackey, the catcher, who was actually the man, as you write about, I didn't know about this until reading your book, was a man who taught Roy Campanella everything he knew and made him into the catcher he became.
Right.
And Biz said in 1954 in your book, you write, the quote was, the fact that I'm not around now, that Negro baseball players are getting a break, bothers me no little. Think of the salary I, along with a lot of other color guys, might have made with the hustle which was typical of our time. Mm-hmm. And talk about Mackey making $375 a month or $2,200 a year, $2,250 a year, playing with the Newark Eagles in 46, 47, and then Junior Gilliam in 54, who was a Negro Baseball League star, and was making $10,000 a year, which was
big money. And all of those stars in the Negro Leagues could have made that money in the majors, you know, if it just hadn't been for the color barrier. And for not only the players, but for many African Americans, that was a source of much angst and frustration and anger, that it was just this arbitrary color barrier that kept African American talent from being able to express itself as fully as whites were able to do. And many felt quite bitter about it. And some of those, you quote, Joe Black was another one who felt quite bitter about the treatment he received. Even though he did actually go on to the Dodgers, he had encounters with Major League scouts.
Yep.
That and the scouts told him, Blacks don't play Major League Baseball, pure and simple. Fortunately, he proved them wrong, but...
He did. He said, this is what you have in your book from Joe Black. The scouts didn't talk to me. They said, color guys don't play baseball. I hated white people. I couldn't understand it. I'm an American. I couldn't play baseball, the number one pastime, is what Joe Black said. And what are your thoughts about all that, Bert? What we were just reading that came out of what some of your compatriots said.
During my time, when I was getting started in baseball, it was unknown. It was not done. You didn't play baseball with whites. You didn't play Major League Baseball. You didn't get drafted by Major League teams. You were black. And the ball that you played, they didn't consider that as Major League Baseball. But we were just as good. Sometimes even better.
So I have to. Oh, I'm sorry. Go ahead, ma'am. We have about 5 minutes left, so we'll have a question here and then an answer. Go ahead.
Thank you. I'm curious as to what kind of avocations or jobs the players had to take on in order to supplement whatever money they made from playing baseball.
Great question.
I didn't hear it.
The question was, what kind of jobs did the players have to take outside of baseball to supplement their income and survive?
Well, after I finished playing baseball, I got a real job. I got a federal job with Social Security Administration. Other fellows found work where they could. A lot of them just stopped playing. But during the off seasons, they found any job that they could find. And some I was fortunate. I went to school. So.
That's you had a college degree.
Yes.
Mm-hmm. We have to wrap it up pretty much now. I can think, came towards the end here, and it's almost hard to know where to end this conversation. We only have like 2 minutes left, I think. But let me ask you this. This is the way to end it. Where were you and what were you feeling the night that Jackie Robinson played his first game?
I was playing college ball, North Carolina A&T. And I felt that maybe if Jackie Robinson could make it, he had been in service, and I had been in service.
You were in World War II?
World War II. And if he could make it, I thought I had a shot. Not knowing that there were hundreds of guys out there that thought the same thing. The Joe Blacks, the Junior Gilliams, the Monty Irvins, and all of them. They thought the same thing, that they had a shot. So I thought I had a shot. So I did what I could. I was getting old. But I did what I could during that time, hoping that someday they may call me. But it never happened.
Well, Bert Simmons, this I have to tell you, it's been an honor and pleasure to meet you. Thank you so much for serving our country in World War II and for playing the game.
Thank you.
And Bob Luce, thank you so much for writing this book. It was a great history. It's a great read. You're a good writer, a wonderful writer. Bob Luce wrote The Baltimore Eli Giants, Sports and Society, and the Age of Negro Baseball, published by Johns Hopkins University Press. Thank you so much.
Thank you very much for having me. It really has been great.
I want to remind you all before we go to get your tickets for a taste of WEAA Spring Benefit. Friday, May 29th, 8 to midnight at the UB Blake National Jazz Institute and Cultural Center. 3 floors of jazz, blues, Latin, Caribbean, reggae, Charles Big Daddy Stallings Blues Band, Tom Reyes Trio, Rodney Kelly Jr. Band, Carter James, and many more. The UB Blake Center is at 847 North Howard. Tickets for Taste of Spring are 443-885-2075. Or just go to WEAA.org and join us there. We're going to dance the night away, and you should come and dance with us. We'd like to thank the Johns Hopkins University Press for inviting us to be involved in this event. The Mark Steiner Show is produced by the Center for Emerging Media. Our producers are Justin Levy and Jessica Phillips. We're engineered by Zachary Coleman. Our interns are Christina Arison, Judith Lloyd, Brian Boone, and Jackson Hubolt. Theme music by Wal Matthews of Clean Cuts. To hear the show again and podcast any of our past shows and hear additional interviews, visit us on the web at steinershow.org. But right now we're going to go taste Darker Than Blues food, which is right outside, which is a great treat. And for Public Radio, WEAA, 88.9 FM, the voice of the community, I'm Mark Steiner. Take care.